The Enduring Impact of the 14th Amendment. On June 8, 1866, 150 years ago, the U.S. Senate passed the 14th Amendment. 2 years later, after being sent to the states, Secretary of State William Seward declared it ratified. The 14th Amendment does a lot. It grants citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. It guarantees due process, and it provides equal protection of civil rights. It is also the most litigated amendment in the U.S. Constitution. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the history of the 14th Amendment and how its protections have been applied over the past century and a half. From freed slaves to same-sex marriage and even presidential races, why this one amendment remains controversial and challenging even in the 21st century. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution consists of five sections. The first concerns citizenship and equal protection. The second, how many representatives each state shall have. The third section prohibits individuals from serving in elected or official office if they have given aid or comfort to enemies of the United States. Section 4 concerns the validity of the public debt. And the final section of the 14th Amendment discusses the ways Congress is to enforce the amendment. Although it is not as well known as other amendments, the 14th is involved in more litigation than any other. Today, we'll learn why. We'll also learn about the amendment's origin and the role a Maine legislator played in getting it enacted. With me in our studio, Patrick Rail. He's a professor of history at Bowdoin College. And on the line with us from the Mix One Studios in Boston is Kenneth Mack. He is the Lawrence D. Beale Professor of Law and Affiliate Professor of History at Harvard University. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
As always, we want to hear from you. How much do you know about the 14th Amendment? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Patrick, I'll start with you for a general history of the 14th Amendment. I take it this was passed during Reconstruction.
That's right. The 14th Amendment was passed by Congress in 1866, 150 years ago this spring. It wasn't ratified for a couple years after that. And its purpose was to solve two critical problems following the Civil War. First, it addressed the status of newly freed slaves and declared them citizens by virtue of their birth in American soil. And second, it protected the rights of citizenship when the states violated them. And there's a story behind that and why that was necessary.
Go ahead.
Well, what had happened is immediately after the Civil War, the former Confederate states quickly rejoined the Union, and as soon as they did that, they began passing a series of discriminatory laws known as Black Codes. And the purpose of the Black Codes was essentially to make sure that the former slaves were sort of substandard citizens. The Black Codes limited their participation in economic life, prohibited them from enjoying the full access to the legal system. In essence, the effort was to make sure that former slaves remained a kind of sub-citizen status, even though they had been freed. Congress rejected this, having spent 750,000 lives winning the Civil War. Many in Congress were not willing to let the Confederacy essentially reimpose slavery in all but name. And the 14th Amendment was part of a package of constitutional amendments and legislative action designed to make sure that if you were free, you had certain minimal rights.
Kenneth, the 14th Amendment was very controversial at the time, and not just because of the issue of the citizenship of freed black men, right? There were bigger issues that were controversial even then and remain controversial today.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment was controversial, as you indicated, not only because it made freed slaves and actually blacks in the North, because in many northern states, for instance, African Americans didn't have equality with whites, that it made African Americans into equal citizens. It's controversial because of that, but it's also controversial because it altered the federal structure of the United States. As most people learn in school, there was the Bill of Rights proposed right after the Constitution was adopted. The Bill of Rights guaranteed certain kinds of fundamental rights, but it guaranteed them against deprivation by the federal government, not by the states. And the problem after the Civil War was that the southern state governments weren't protecting the basic citizenship rights of African Americans in the South. So the United States government structure sort of presumed that local states would protect citizens and their rights to contract, to own property, and would protect them from violence, because the other story of the post-Civil War era is not only the Black Codes, but just rampant violence that was perpetrated against freed people in the South with basically no state protection. So in order to protect freed slaves, Congress had to alter the federal structure of the United States and pass a constitutional amendment, which was very different from the Bill of Rights, which only applied to the federal government, but passed a constitutional amendment that guaranteed certain fundamental rights against state deprivation. And, you know, that's a set of issues that we continue to argue about up until today.
So for the first time, civil rights were seen as federal government, as federal law superseding the state law.
Yes, federal law superseding the state law. Very controversial proposition. There have been lots of suspicion of the central federal government. You know, anyone who's sort of seen the play Hamilton, or actually you can't really see it, listen to the soundtrack, you sort of know this. You know, this is the story of the adoption of the Constitution. Lots of suspicion of the federal government, but in fact, only the federal government was going to be able to protect these fundamental rights for freed African Americans in the South.
Patrick, I understand a Maine senator, a U.S. senator from Maine, William Fessenden, was critical to the existence of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, Fessenden had an interesting role in this whole process. Fessenden was a real statesman. He was one of the most respected members of the Senate. And he supported, he represents the ambivalence that many of the politicians of the day brought to this issue. It seems in retrospect that passing the 14th Amendment was sort of a no-brainer. Of course, we have to protect the rights of these people. But as Professor Mack was saying, this involved a fundamental transformation in the ordering of federal power. So there was a lot of ambivalence over it. And Fessenden is a good representative of that ambivalence. He believed in the 14th Amendment. He encouraged the former Confederate states to pass it. But when they balked at doing this, he didn't want to push the issue too hard. He thought that it was, to quote, better leave the matter where it was rather than compel the Southern states' submission. So in the end, the Congress and the White House wound up in a showdown that led to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. And Fessenden was a critical vote against impeachment. So on the one hand, Fessenden supported civil rights for African Americans. He supported the 14th Amendment. But on the other, he wasn't willing to take this, what was understood at the time to be kind of a revolution. He didn't want to take it too far. He's a great example of the moderation that ultimately prevailed in this fight.
But in the end, he is the man, I understand, is this right, that introduced the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Senate?
Well, it was he became the kind of nominal sponsor in the Senate. It was argued most vociferously in the House by a guy named John Bynum, who I believe was from Indiana, who really gave the arguments for why the 14th Amendment should be passed.
Okay. Professor Mack, what we know most about the 14th Amendment is due process. We cannot deny life, liberty, or property without due process by law, and also the citizenship, giving citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States. But there are other elements of the 14th Amendment that are also important. Can you talk about those?
Yes. There was the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which at the time it was enacted looked like it was going to be the place where the action was. It said that no state shall enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And it seemed to sort of incorporate some kind of fundamental right. But the Supreme Court, in a case called the Slaughterhouse Cases in 1873, more or less read that clause out of the 14th Amendment. Of course, equal protection, the Equal Protection Clause, is one of the big places where the reaction is in the 14th Amendment. It's our fundamental guarantee against certain kinds of discrimination, primarily race discrimination, but it's figured in lots of other decisions. So, for instance, the Obergefell decision, the gay marriage decision, cited the 14th Amendment among other parts of the Constitution. There are other parts of the 14th Amendment, too. There's Section 2, which seems to say that if a state doesn't enfranchise all its male inhabitants, then it has its representation in Congress reduced. And that was passed in order to encourage the southern states to to give African Americans the vote. Voting rights for African Americans was very controversial at the time and has been controversial through most of American history. And it was passed to give the states incentive to give African Americans in the South voting rights. And then, of course, as you mentioned, there was a Section 3, which is about trying to prevent people from holding office who had participated in the Confederate rebellion against the United States government. And then Section 4 was about the making sure the public debt of the United States was valid and would not be legally questioned.
Why is this the most litigated amendment in the U.S. Constitution?
I think it's the most litigated amendment because it did something that nothing else had done. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, and that was a big deal. But the 13th Amendment arguably didn't change the structure of the federal government. The 15th Amendment is phrased sort of negatively. It says that, you know, the right to vote can't be deprived based on race, but it doesn't say that there's affirmative right to vote guaranteed by national law. But the 14th Amendment has a number of clauses in it that are basic guarantees of rights that apply all over the country, that apply against state governments, and basically anyone who's been looking for some kind of national fundamental right since 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified has looked to the 14th Amendment as a place to start.
Boy, Patrick, when I listen to Professor Mack speak, I'm thinking about so many issues that are forefront of our popular our cultural discussion today, whether it's voter ID, whether it's transgender people using bathrooms, whether the debate about whether some presidential candidates should be citizens because they were born in Canada. Can you add to the list? What else is a legacy of the 14th Amendment?
The 14th Amendment was instrumental in the Japanese internment during World War II. It was the Supreme Court decided that the 14th Amendment did not apply in that instance to American citizens. So historically, it's been an extremely important focus for judicial controversy. And I think one of the reasons that this is so is that in many ways, the 14th Amendment defined American citizenship for the first time. Before this, it wasn't exactly clear what constituted American citizenship. It wasn't exactly clear what freedom entailed. So it was one thing to declare that 4 million people could no longer be treated as legal property, but what did that actually mean? What did it mean to not be a slave? What rights did that confer? And the 14th Amendment provided a foundation for liberty by essentially defining federal citizenship, defining the relationship between federal and state citizenship, and by helping to specify what the rights were that went along with it. I think that's why it has become a touchstone. The interesting thing about that, though, is that even though it seems as if the 14th Amendment should have created the rules by which we all live, the reality is that the law is an organic living thing and that it has been consistently contested, as Professor Mack has suggested. So even though it seems like Everything should have been settled by the 14th Amendment. It actually just opened the door for a whole new and very long-standing set of legal controversies.
It's interesting, Professor Mack. I'm guessing, and you tell me if this is true, that the way in which the 14th Amendment is viewed today by the members of our own Supreme Court is different among justices.
Yeah, very different among justices. There's been a big debate through, I think, all of the period since the 14th Amendment was enacted among the Supreme Court about how broad its reach is. It's appropriate to mention that this year Justice Scalia passed away. Justice Scalia, on many issues, wanted to interpret the 14th Amendment very narrowly. You know, there was a big debate about, you know, what did it mean at the time of its enactment? And Justice Scalia was one of the people who was very much influenced by a set of writers who essentially went back and read the Reconstruction Congress debates. You know, the Congress during Reconstruction sort of framed and set the words to the 14th Amendment, then sent it to the states for ratification. A bunch of people went back and read those debates and realized that these congressmen were a bunch of racists, which actually, you know, that's a controversial proposition, but some people believe that. And if you believe that, then you believe that Congress didn't really want to do a lot in the 14th Amendment. It should be very narrowly read. And Justice Scalia was one of those people who read it very narrowly. Justice Kennedy, in some ways, reads it narrowly, but on some issues, for instance, gay rights, has been willing to read it quite broadly. So there's a big debate there, and there's always been a big debate within the United States Supreme Court about how broadly or narrowly to read the 14th Amendment.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm especially interested in what you think about who rights apply to. What is the definition of somebody covered by the 14th Amendment, somebody who has civil rights as a citizen of the United States? Clearly, those who crafted the 14th Amendment were not even thinking about gay marriage or transgender rights, but it is very much a part of the conversation today. So please join us. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
Hello, I'm Razia Iqbal. At BBC NewsHour, we give you access to the world's largest network of correspondents to deliver unbiased news and analysis on events around the globe. From the biggest stories of the day to the important issues and trends, BBC NewsHour feeds your global curiosity. Maine Public Radio now offers a full hour of BBC NewsHour at 9 each weekday morning. I hope you can join me and my colleagues as we try to make sense of a complex world.
To take a look at our two new program schedules and to get more information, including how to listen to the new Maine Public Classical channel, please visit mpbn.net. MPBN is proud to be a media sponsor of People of the First Light, the new core exhibit at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor. Designed to introduce visitors to the Wabanaki world, People of the First Light immerses visitors by sharing stories, culture, and history through the lens of contemporary Wabanaki. MPBN members are eligible for 2-for-1 tickets for the exhibit. For details on the Abbey Museum and the MPBN member discount, please visit mpbn.net and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the importance of the 14th Amendment. With me in the studio, Patrick Rail, professor of history at Bowdoin College. On the line with us, Harvard University professor Kenneth Mack. He's the author of Representing the Race, The Creation of the Civil Rights Lawyer. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Patrick, we were talking about some of the ways in which the 14th Amendment is still alive today, still pertinent to the national conversation. And one of those ways is in the whole conversation about immigration. And in fact, in the 1860s, this was also in some ways about immigration. What is the same and what is different?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a lot of conversation and discussion in our day about the 14th Amendment. Some people believe that its promise of birthright citizenship, the notion that anyone born on American soil is an American citizen, that should be challenged. These are concerns about immigration, anchor babies. These are really hotly contested issues in our day, and some argue that the 14th Amendment was not intended to apply in those instances. If you go back and read the debates around the 14th Amendment, though, I think it's interesting to note that this was actually a conversation that was had at the time. In Congress, legislators acknowledged that some people who were presently not considered citizens, people of Asian descent in the West, for example, would in fact become citizens by virtue of the 14th Amendment. So this was a conversation that was had back in the day. I think the larger issue around this is this question that Professor Mack raised about how later generations should construe the 14th Amendment. Should we read it strictly, literally, according to what is presumed to be the original intent of its framers, or should we read it a little bit more loosely? There are actually plausible arguments on both sides of that debate.
All right. We're going to go to our first call. We've got Phoebe calling from Camden. Hi, Phoebe. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes, I'm calling because a few years ago, quite recently actually, we mounted a citizen petition in Maine for a 28th Amendment, which would say that corporations are not persons and money is not speech. And this was in reaction to the Citizens United ruling. And our understanding was that corporate personhood was quite well established in law just by accumulated cases. And the 14th Amendment, which was supposed to help with slaves and making slaves citizens, had been used by corporations for a long time to establish as part of their getting Bill of Rights for corporations. Considering them as though they were people.
Yeah, Ken Mack, would you like to talk about the role of the 14th Amendment in the Citizens United case?
Yeah, well, Citizens United is a very complicated case. It has to do with political contributions as political speech. It isn't necessarily premised on there being corporate personhood. there's been a big debate ever since the 14th Amendment was ratified about who can use it and for what purposes. And there were a series of cases. There was one case in particular in the 19th century which seemed to recognize personhood for corporations. And that case has been sort of bandied about over the years. But mostly what Citizens Unite does is it recognizes that people speak through ownership of corporations, and they own shares, and those corporations supposedly do things, but you don't really have to have an idea that there's a corporate personhood to say that political contributions are speech. Now, Citizens United is a very complicated decision. I'm not in favor of the decision, but it's complicated how to overturn it. But I think it's mostly based on the premise that political contribution should be treated like speech, which is a little separate from the idea of corporate personhood.
Though that principle of corporate personhood is still something that is an important topic of conversation these days. And I think the broader issue that it illustrates is how the 14th Amendment, we can set these rules, but the standards that we use around the 14th Amendment seem to shift almost organically as our standards change. So something that was once fully within the scope of the 14th Amendment, or at least the Supreme Court declared it to be, like the segregation in public places, racial segregation in public places, as in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, can change so that by 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education comes around, the same thing, public segregation, is then deemed no longer to be permissible under the 14th Amendment. So we've sort of set these rules, but then we kind of argue about how they should be applied, what they really mean.
All right. Phoebe, thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566, send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Professor Mack, what is the role of the 14th Amendment in the current spate of voter ID laws around the country?
Well, our main constitutional protection of voting rights is actually the 15th Amendment rather than the 14th. The 14th tried to do it indirectly in Section 2, in which it, provision never really enforced that if, states didn't enfranchise all their adult males, then they would have the representation in Congress reduced. The 14th Amendment does have an equal protection clause. It also has Section 5, which allows Congress to enforce the amendment by legislation. The 15th Amendment is our main voting rights clause, constitutional protection, but it's phrased negatively. The right to vote can't be deprived on the basis of race. And essentially what's happened is that the right to vote has been deprived on the basis of race historically and many, many times after the 15th Amendment. It was just done indirectly so that Southern states did not want African Americans to vote. They understood they couldn't pass a statute saying that African Americans can't vote, so they did it indirectly. They did it first with literacy requirements, which everybody understood, African Americans in the South had mostly been slaves. They had a higher illiteracy rate than whites. Everybody understood that a literacy requirement would fall more heavily on African Americans. It was a subterfuge for preventing African Americans from voting. And and the subterfuges got more blatant as time went on. There were things like the grandfather clause, which said if your grandfather could vote, like when whites only could vote, then you could vote. So we have to think about the recent spate of voter IDs in light of this history. I mean, most of the threats to voting rights after the 15th Amendment have not been sort of direct prohibitions on voting based on race. It's been all these indirect things, which everybody understood had the effect of preventing certain kinds of people, mostly African Americans, from voting. And the people who are challenging the voter ID laws are lodging themselves in that tradition that that most of the challenges to voting rights, particularly based on race, have been indirect, things that everybody understood falls more heavily on one group of people rather than another.
This is a really interesting example of the ways that law and practice don't always match up. The effort to disfranchise African Americans in the late 19th century relied on ostensibly race-neutral language so it would not violate the 14th or 15th Amendments. Of course, the intent was to do exactly that. And when the Supreme Court began adjudicating these cases, essentially it found that because the overt strictures had not been violated by these new laws, they were completely fine. That is something that has changed over the years, so that even though the law, or the amendment stays the same, the interpretation of it has changed, such that by the time we get to the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, practices that were once deemed to be completely within the 14th Amendment or 15th Amendment were then deemed not and requiring of remedy. And it was those remedies from 1965 that the Supreme Court has recently helped dismantle.
Professor Mack, is there conflict between the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment in any cases? And can you give us examples if that's the case?
I have to kind of think about your question. I think you mean the free speech protections of the First Amendment?
Well, and the religious liberty, some of the cases being heard, not in Maine, but around the country right now. What many believe is a conflict between the freedom of religion and some of the civil rights laws being enacted around the country today.
Yeah, and the way I think about this is something we might call freedom of association. There's a long history of sort of freedom of association claims being made in the context of the 14th Amendment, meaning the 14th Amendment shouldn't apply to this particular thing because this particular thing I'm doing is private. It has something to do with my ability to associate with people and form associations, groups, and some of those groups should be allowed to discriminate. White Southerners who didn't like the 14th Amendment always said it imposed social equality, that, you know, we have our private organizations, we have our private this and private that, and that these things should not be subject to the reach of the 14th Amendment. Of course, you know, the defenders of segregation, you know, lodged their defense in religious liberty. They claimed that segregation was part of their core religious belief. These kinds of objections were all historically swept aside. In the context of gay marriage and certain kinds of protections for gays and lesbians and LGBTQ people, we're having this debate again. And the counterargument is a bit more robust here than it's been in the past, not only because of religious protections, but lots of people think that, this is sort of a new issue and we should be able to protect our local traditions, our religious traditions, our right to have certain kinds of private aspects of our life, are associations that are protected from the reach of the 14th Amendment.
Professor Rail, you're nodding.
Yeah, this is a fascinating aspect of this history, that what were once essentially deemed rights of association, the ability to sell to whoever you wanted or buy from whoever you wanted to, have changed. Those things that were once not covered by the amendment are now often deemed to. So this is all predicated on the basic American principle that government governs best, that governs least. And where these changes have come from, though, is the notion that if rights of association are so broad that they deny some citizens the capacity to participate in the economy on equal ground, they become something that government has an interest in protecting. And these were established in the cases in the 1960s and 1970s, largely over the right to discriminate in housing against African Americans. And in these instances, the courts have generally ruled that you can't profit off of race, that you can't you can't deny someone the capacity to participate equally in the economy. So the questions that are coming up these days about retailers who might not wish to sell to everybody are actually issues that we've been talking about for decades now.
All right. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about the legacy of the 14th Amendment. Please stay with us.
You make MaineCalling possible, as do the Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering minimally invasive valve surgery. Learn more at cmhvi.org. And Friends School of Portland, where Quaker values create a culture of joyful learning. Information at friendsschoolofportland.org. You're listening to Maine Public Radio. We also offer our new Maine Public Classical Channel, 160 hours of great listening each week, including all your favorites from years past here on Maine Public Radio, and so much more. You can stream the new signal on your computer, smartphone, or tablet, and hook up or perhaps use Bluetooth to listen on your home stereo. We're also building an FM network for Maine Public Classical, and we already have stations on 106.1 Bangor, 99.7 Waterville, and 91.5 Freiburg, and there are more to come. Lastly, where you listen to Maine Public Radio now, you can probably hear Maine Public Classical very well with an HD radio receiver. Need help? We have all the information you need and videos online at mpbn.net.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the importance and the history of the 14th Amendment. With me in the studio, Bowdoin College History Professor Kenneth Rail, and on the line with us, Harvard University Law and History Professor Kenneth Mack. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Dean calling from Sullivan. Hi, Dean. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to make a comment about what's happening with this, the transgender, you know, the controversy over the bathrooms and this and that. And I want to applaud President Obama for what he's done. But a lot of people are talking about this like this is a recent phenomena. And the only thing that's relatively recent about it is that they've been treating transgender youth in recent years with hormone blockers so they don't have to go through puberty and be subjected to a lot of the, the oppression and, discrimination that adults have had to go through. So this is why you're seeing it in the schools. Historically, this has always been a problem for adults. It's like every time I use a public bathroom, over the years, there's been a lot of angst. Until in recent years when I've had all my surgeries. The problem for people to say they're uncomfortable with the idea of somebody that doesn't have, quote, the proper genitals be using their bathroom, that it's uncomfortable for them. Consider somebody that leaves their house and is not and doesn't feel safe using a public bathroom. I mean, it just blows me away how insensitive people are to this issue.
Dean, is it interesting to you that the basis for the president's decision the basis for all of this change in the law comes from something that was passed in Reconstruction for freed slaves?
I'm sorry, I'm not clear about what the question is.
Oh, I'm just saying, is it interesting to you that the basis for something that's obviously so personal and so important for you is a law that was derived for somebody that was not you. It was somebody, a freed slave in the South 150 years ago.
No, I definitely see a correlation. In fact, I'm rereading Uncle Tom's Cabin right now. You know, there's a lot of correlations, and I've always been really hypersensitive to what happens in the black community. And there's definitely correlations with all oppressed people. And I just applaud all those efforts and Black Lives Matter and Al Sharpton. It's just astounding how supportive he's been of transgender people over the years. I mean, it's a lot of people don't even understand trans issues. We've been the T tacked it onto LBGT. I mean, it's like people don't understand even the transgender, even the distinctions between the transgender community. By and large, what you're talking about when you're talking about bathroom issues, you're talking about transsexuals.
Right.
You're not talking about, somebody that is necessarily, there's transgendered people that,
Dean, I really appreciate your call. I'm going to give our guests a chance to respond. Professor Mack.
Yeah, the caller raises a really big issue. People have been reimagining the 14th Amendment ever since it was ratified. One of the earlier callers talked about corporations using the 14th Amendment. And it's got this broad language in it, like things like equal protection of the laws, like life, liberty, and property. And ever since it was ratified, Congress wrote broad language. It didn't say, you can't pass a law that discriminates against black people. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 sort of says that. But when they got around to writing a constitutional amendment, they wrote really broad language, and people began to use it. Just in direct reference to what the caller was talking about, one of the people I write about in my book is a woman named Pauli Murray, who was an African-American lawyer who was one of the people who was responsible for creating sex discrimination law in the 1960s. She herself felt herself to be, she thought that she was a man trapped in a woman's body. And I try not to sort of label her further in the book, but that's what she thought. And she sort of struggled with this issue her entire life. And kind of out of that struggle, she basically reads the 14th Amendment not only to prohibit race discrimination, but to prohibit sex discrimination. And she convinced a whole bunch of people, notably Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that she's right. So there's been a long tradition of people sort of taking that broad language and thinking about what does it mean and running with it.
And an equally broad tradition pressing against that, for better or worse. In the Obergefell ruling, the dissenters, the conservative dissenters, essentially argued a strict constructionist position that John Roberts said that the Constitution had nothing to do with the majority's decision. Samuel Alito said that the majority's ruling was an abuse of its authority. And so this is the perspective that says that, well, we need to think about the intention of the framers. We need to interpret the language as strictly as possible. I find that not a completely compelling argument in the instance of the 14th Amendment, because the framers actually understood themselves to be laying out principles that could be applied not simply to the case of former slaves, but to anybody who was seeking redress by the federal government from state discrimination. In fact, the defenders of the 14th at the time said that this was something that would serve everyone for all the hereafter. But the argument that strict construction is the way to go has some plausibility. It can be claimed that if we interpret passages of the Constitution so loosely that they stray too far from their original intent, that we're essentially amending the Constitution without the full process that the founders intended for that purpose.
All right. Well, we're going to move along. We're going to move to Chris, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for the time and the guests. This is a great show. To me, when I think about the 14th Amendment, I think about equal protection under the law. I think about what one man can do, another man can do. And I think that how my particular generation is reinventing the idea of what this means to us is when we look at places like casinos where they're allowed to have slot machines, but other small businesses can't apply to get slot machines. And so what happens is they kind of concentrate the wealth in the hands of the few rather than, you know, if those people are eligible for a license, anybody should be eligible for a license, similar like in Canada. And then as an extension of that, another looking at this further, we're looking at the felonization of America. In states that have legalized cannabis, like Washington and Colorado, what has happened is people who had marijuana-related felonies in those states before can't participate in the licensing process. And because there's a huge racial disparity between the people, the white people prosecuted and the black people prosecuted, this is basically kind of denying them their equal protection to participate in the licensing process. So, you know, I'm just kind of throwing that out there. It frustrates me when I can't apply for licenses that big corporations can apply for. So,
interesting. Yeah. Chris, interesting take on interpreting the 14th Amendment. Professor Mack, are these arguments you've heard before?
Yeah, there are arguments that go all the way back to, as I keep saying, the moment the 14th Amendment was ratified. You know, one of the early cases interpreting the amendment, it's called the Slaughterhouse Cases. They had to do with a law in New Orleans that required, you know, New Orleans had this sort of yellow fever epidemic. They slaughtered beef, but they slaughtered beef upstream from New Orleans rather than downstream. So they pass a law saying, okay, you got to go slaughter your beef at this one place, and they incorporate a corporation to administer that one place. But then all these butchers who used to slaughter the beef up River, who were mostly white butchers, decided that this law violated the 14th Amendment, that they claimed that it denied them the right to practice their trade, that it was a special dispensation to a corporation which had been incorporated to administer the central butchering site. And you might think, wow, that has nothing to do with what the framers of the 14th Amendment were worrying about. But then again, they wrote this broad language. And that broad language was enough to convince a couple of justices of the Supreme Court that they were right. And the Supreme Court ultimately rejected that charge, but over the next couple of decades, they would actually accept it and in a series of cases hold that the 14th Amendment protected certain kinds of economic rights, mostly economic rights for corporations, but nonetheless economic rights, when you might think, oh, well, if we went back to the framers, they weren't really thinking about that. But then again, they wrote the broad language.
I think it raises an interesting question. To the caller's point, a cynic, somebody who was not particularly happy with the way these decisions are sometimes handed down, could wonder of what value is that constitutional language if it's in practice, if historically it has been interpreted so variably and so widely, if something that was deemed completely acceptable in 1896 is no longer acceptable in 1954, what does that really mean about our constitutional and legal system? How much of it is really about the language versus how much of it is about the kinds of contemporary values that we bring to these questions?
Chris, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Kenny Bunk and John. John, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. John.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for having this this show. I think it's a very important and timely topic. My question for your guest, why do you think that there's not more direct public discussion relative to the actions that continue since the Voting Rights Act? Since Brown versus the Board of Education, when the political motives are very clearly the same reasons they were post Civil War.
Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, in some ways, we might suggest that the public mood around these kinds of issues has turned backwards. What's interesting, if you look at the measures that are being passed in the states right now to restrict voting rights, is that they are framed in the same race-neutral way that the old measures are, although they clearly have the same race-specific kinds of effects. And I think the fact that this can happen is evidence of where the public mood is in this country, and the fact that the Supreme Court can essentially state that a majority of the Supreme Court can state that these are acceptable and that they're not violate, or that we should actually undo part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, suggests to some people where we are headed and what the power of the court is in actually interpreting these things. Until recently, we've had a slight majority for the conservative side of the court, and that was the consequence. We'll see what happens now. But thoughtful people might ask, what is our American system about when just one member on the Supreme Court can change the outcomes so drastically?
John, thanks. Yeah. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, just to add to that, the Shelby County versus Holder case, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act, which was a provision that required certain areas of the country to pre-clear. If they'd made changes in their voting laws, they had to pre-clear them with the Department of Justice. And, just to Professor Rail's point about sort of inventing new constitutional rights, it's not at all clear on what constitutional basis they struck down the Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act. They sort of say it's kind of an insult to the particular jurisdictions that were covered, but, you know, Chief Justice Roberts isn't very clear about exactly where the constitutional power comes from. But nonetheless, he invalidates it. And in fact, the Voting Rights Act was a big compromise. It had been amended various times. It had been amended actually quite recently. And the Democrats and Republicans in Congress had compromised, and each of them had gotten sort of part of what they wanted. And the Supreme Court basically made up a new constitutional right and used it to invalidate the statute. And now we have voter ID laws proliferating, which in many of the jurisdictions in which they are proliferating were jurisdictions that were covered by Section 4B. So a consequence of this, you know, we constantly reinvent the Constitution. I mean, that is one of the themes of this hour. And one of the consequences of that particular reinvention was the proliferation of voter ID laws.
John, thanks so much for your call. We just have a little bit of time left, and I want to ask each of you just briefly where you see the 14th Amendment being applied next. What are issues that, you know, haven't quite hit the headlines yet, but you see as potential national debates that are relevant to the 14th Amendment in the near future? Go ahead, Professor Mack.
Sure. I think the citizenship clause, clause that says if you're born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, you're a citizen of the United States and of your own state, is going to be subject to controversy going into the future. We've got all these debates about things called anchor babies and all this other stuff. And, I think for, 150 years, everybody has assumed that what that clause meant was that everybody who was born here, with a few exceptions like children of diplomats and certain other categories like that, was a citizen. And I think we are clearly going to have a debate about the meaning of that clause, and that debate is going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court and is going to be had by all sectors of our society going forward. Of course, the LGBTQ issues are going to continue to proliferate and be debated probably for the next generation.
And Patrick Riel, what do you think?
I think those are important hot-button issues. Another may be continuing controversies over the role of race in undergraduate admissions in colleges and universities. So there have been challenges to using racial preferences in admissions. Here's another area where rights conflict, and the 14th Amendment is totally at stake.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. What an interesting conversation. Patrick Riel, you just heard from, professor of history at Bowdoin College. Kenneth Mack is Lawrence D. Beale professor of law and affiliate professor of history at Harvard University. He's the author of Representing the Race, The Creation of the Civil Rights Lawyer. If you look on our MPBN Main Calling Facebook page, you'll see a link to an event on Wednesday, June 1st at the Portland Public Library. Professor Mack will be there, as will others, a public forum on the 14th Amendment. That's June 1st, and you can find information on our Facebook page. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. Excuse me. One of our interns, Hadley Britt, answered your calls. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.